is up. Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd, my co-host, of course. He is Thomas Drance. He also covers the team at The Athletic. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, footwear, and orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drance, what's going on?
Hey, buddy. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, and got a good show lined up today. We're going to chat with Scott Wheeler, also from The Athletic, at 1 as we finally turn our attention to the NHL draft a little bit here on the show. We'll chat everything with about the draft with Scott at 1, and then Kevin Woodley will join us at 1:30, of course, from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. And I'm really excited because we're now... You know, we've finished kind of digesting and reflecting on the Stanley Cup final and the fact that the Panthers are back-to-back champions, and we're now really turning our sights to one of the busiest times in the NHL calendar, which is this span from right now through the draft Friday and Saturday, and then a few days after that next week, free agency opens on July 1st. So basically 8 days of frenzied rumors, transactions, activity. And this is, you know, we've been talking so long about the Canucks' efforts to reshape their forward group, kind of reset the trajectory of their team. And it's always been a theoretical, you know, well, when the time comes, what are they going to be able to do? Well, we're here. We are in the time. And I understand it's going to be a bit of a trickle until the real, you know, the fireworks factory of draft day itself at the end of the week. But we are like, this is, I don't know, the sweet part of the bat, if we're using a baseball analogy or something. We are in the thick of it right now, starting right now in the NHL.
Yeah, you wake up and there's new signings, new trades, yep, right off the hop. I mean, you know, it's not just hitting the sweet part of the bat, Jamie. You can hear that it's leaving the ballpark.
That's right.
The moment it connects. And it's going to be like this on a daily, hourly even basis between now and July 1st. And, you know, I think the stakes are really high for this Vancouver Canucks organization, for this franchise in this moment. I think there's a pretty pronounced sense of local skepticism. We know how miserable last season was. Mm-hmm. We know that there's a desire to change things up. Things have already changed with some of the moves that the club made before the NHL trade deadline and some of the moves they didn't. You know, the I think desire to see this team, you know, kind of the poke with a stick meme, do something.
Yes.
Is sky high here. Mm-hmm. And it should be, right? I think fans want something different. And by different, I don't necessarily mean I'm not doing the like lobby for a rebuild thing, but fresh faces are required, right? Fresh faces are required. A team that, you know, can credibly sell some hope locally, I think is required, especially, you know, in the context of Quinn Hughes' Canucks future and how much that anxiety is dominating the conversation in this market around this team. And so, you know, as we sort of go forward here, the big sort of news of the day and news of the weekend was like the circle back on Pugh Suter.
Yep.
Right. And we argued and debated about it on Friday. And we'll do more of that today, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's what we do, baby. But also... But also, the truth is that Pugh Suter and circling back on Pugh Suter and paying market rate for Pugh Suter, as much as I'm like the president of the Pugh Suter fan club, I don't think that's going to cut it in terms of exciting or galvanizing this market, right? I don't even know if that's going to make like the most dead-end Canucks hopefulists, right? Mm-hmm. The like chronic, like I'm talking, this is a person who was like a dye-in-the-wool Benning bro, right? Who made fun of the idea that this team should rebuild when they were going off, made fun of PDO in the fall of 2023, really thought they had a chance to beat the Oilers, right? Thought, spent all of last summer saying they were so close, right? I'm talking that level of person, right? I don't even know if that person is going to be like, Pugh Suter, okay, good. At least we solved the
issue. Phew, thank goodness. And when we were having that debate last week, somebody texted in, we didn't get a chance to read it on air, but they made a really good point referencing a Jim Rutherford quote from the end of year media availability. And this one had kind of slipped my mind a little bit, possibly because we were just like flush with great Jim Rutherford quotes to think about and dwell on. But Rutherford made the point that about, you know, prices potentially being very high for impact second line centers or top of the lineup forwards. And he made this the point that, yeah, it's going to be painful to do it, but it might be even more painful not to do it. Right. And so that is very much the standard that management themselves has set out, that like when you start thinking like that, it's like it doesn't make sense to shy away from paying the prices. You yourself said it's going to be potentially more painful not to get it done. And I think that it's not exactly like, I think probably fans would have felt that way anyways. But then you hear the president say it and he's like, yeah, he's right. He's being honest.
Yes.
We're all on the same page here. But it just increases the expectations even more that they are able to follow through and get it done.
Yeah. And, you know, the issue that we were debating on Friday's show, and honestly, we probably could have done a full 2 hours just on the should they or shouldn't they of the Pew Suter circle back. And my point is that I can't stand, I think it's a deeply distressing, scary process indicator for this management team to have, if this turns out with them like acceding to Pew Suter's market rate.
Yep.
You know, 4.5 was the number that Elliot Friedman was talking about on Donnie and Dolly earlier today. And, you know, 4.5, like, obviously, right? I mean, we live in a world where Trent Frederick just signed for basically 4x8, right? We live in a world where Ryan Donato signed for 4x4. I like Ryan Donato as a player, right? But he can't play center the way Pew Suter can. He certainly can't hang in tough minutes the way Suter can in terms of his defensive play. You know, that said, Donato, like, I like Donato a lot. I think he's a solid, like, middle six spark plug offensive guy with some grit to him, despite sort of his stature. And, you know, I guess Zetterlund would be the other guy out in Ottawa. He was barely a factor for that team in the playoffs, and he got 4x3, right? So this is kind of like 4.5 for Pew Suter. When he's a credible center answer, even if he's probably not best deployed as a full-time center because, you know, his utility isn't moving around the lineup. You know, that to me, that's like, yeah, that feels like a minimum, to be totally honest with you. Like, I don't think he's going to have trouble beating that in the marketplace. And it concerns me for this team to have been, you know, sort of out on the idea of doubling his salary before the trade deadline. And then to have come up to like 3.5-ish, right? Like we'd do 3.5-ish a month ago. And then to be here considering and you know, talking about, if not altogether that seriously, and exchanging offers just yet, you know, a 4.5. I mean, I just don't think you can win like that. Like if you made the decision months ago that, hey, we need to do better at center, we don't think that we can win paying Pew Suter $4 million, I don't think you can change that viewpoint and sort of face the fans in this market, right? The detail oriented obsessive fans in this market and say, yeah, we have a plan. Right. And that to me is scarier in some ways than the prospect of going without a floor raising, you know, middle six ace like Suter.
Now there's another angle to this, the Suter and the Brock Besser part, which was kind of making me pull my hair out today as well before the show. And this is in connection with the Trevor Zegras deal, which went down today. And of course, Zegras is someone.
Well, don't pull your hair out, bud. Trust me. Like, don't, you can't spare it. You can have some of mine.
I'm doing all the heavy lifting in the hair department on this show. So I got to preserve it. I got to preserve my advantage there.
Wow.
What?
Shots fired.
What? Come on.
Shots fired.
Look, I gotta accept like my advantages where I can get them here. Anyway, so Trevor Zegras traded from Anaheim to Philly this morning. And of course, we've mentioned Trevor Zegras as a potential candidate, as a potential target for the Canucks. A lot of warts, but that's also maybe why the price was going to be more affordable. And I did see some people react with like shock, like, whoa, that's all it took to get Trevor Zegras. I wasn't expecting it to take a lot more than that. Like, I think people maybe had not quite fully grasped just how much the bloom was off the rose for Trevor Zegras. Like, if anything, you could convince me that this was more than I was expecting Trevor Zegras to go for. It was Ryan Poehling, a second and a fourth from Philadelphia. But one of the things that Rick Dhaliwal mentioned on Donnie and Dolly today was, you know, they included two picks in that deal, and Vancouver has been unwilling to go multiple picks in these offers, right? They made a Marco Rossi deal that was the 15th and a player. Mason Marchment went for a couple of picks. if that's the case, like if there's this unwillingness to include multiple, and we're not talking multiple firsts here. We're talking like the Mason margin was what, a third and a fourth. This was a second and a fourth. If there's an internal idea of it, like, nah, that doesn't make sense. We don't have enough picks. We can't do that. That makes keeping Besser and Suter at the deadline just so much more infuriating to me. Like that, and this is not hindsight at all. This is what I was saying and other people were saying for weeks leading up to the deadline. If you're not going to get a deal done with these guys, go get that ammunition so you can make moves in the summer. And now we're in the summer and it's like, well, we don't have enough ammunition. Well, I wonder why. I wonder why you don't have enough ammunition. And this is also what drives me nuts about the, well, you know, why bother getting a third round pick? Well, apparently now we're hearing that they're unwilling to include third round picks in deals for legitimate, credible NHL players who could help them. That's why you go out and get those third round picks.
So I would say that the equivalent trade, realistically, of paling a second and a fourth from Vancouver to Anaheim, right? The equivalent package is probably something like Drew O'Connor.
Sure.
A second and a fourth.
Yep.
And so I can understand anyway, at least to some extent, why that the Canucks wouldn't necessarily be gung-ho about that, especially for a player where, you know, in Zegras, right, if you're right about him, well, his upside's not locked in, right? If you're right about him and he goes off next year and does what he's absolutely skilled enough to do while improving a bit defensively, you know, it's not like you're getting a long-term bargain here. He's going to be immediately very, very pricey, which was the same thing with the Filip Hronek bet that I, you know, was critical of, right? That it's hard to realize a ton of long-term upside with this player because immediately they're going to become very expensive. So, you know, I can at least understand why the club would view that as an excessive price, especially if they rate him as a winger,
yes,
which a lot of teams around the league do. Guys like 40% in the circle. He really struggles there, and he really struggles below the hash marks defensively. And, you know, I think one thing to keep in mind here is for all that I think fans would be shocked to hear that, like, you know, Rick Tocchet's very excited about this trade. I guarantee you that Rick Tocchet's very excited about this trade. And I think it's partly that, you know, A, if you're a coach who has a lot of, like, pride and belief in your ability to teach defense,
mm-hmm,
right, then you're willing to take swings at gifted young guys whose sort of big issue is their defensive play, in part because you're like, well, I can improve them there, right? Like, I'm betting on myself and betting on the talent, right? Obviously, the risk profile of this deal is favorable from Philadelphia's point of view, and they're going to try him at center, right? So it's like, they're going to try him at center. I mean, look at their wing depth. Look at how they're built, right? Like, look at what they're, so you can understand why they would have been a little bit more in than Vancouver, and that might have made the difference here. So, yeah, I mean, it's two picks, but it's also a player, and, you know, Paling's not more than a fourth line player, but, you know, I think that's equivalent to Drew O'Connor, frankly, right?
Yep.
Sort of. Except that Drew O'Connor has the contract. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of this deal. Certainly, it's a bit of business, much like the Mason Marchment deal where the Canucks, you know, I think we would have been, like, I think this market would be pretty excited if at this point in the offseason the Canucks had already done Marchment and Zegras.
Yeah, and let's say you'd done Marchment and Zegras and you still had your first overall, or sorry, your first round pick, right? 15th overall, right?
I will say, though, neither of those guys are fast. Like,
no.
That's a slow forward group when you add that to what the Canucks already have. And so I can understand, like, I'm not saying that if they'd done those deals, I'd be over the moon picking the Canucks as, like, a for sure playoff team or anything. I'm just saying I think the market would have been excited by one or two of those deals if the Canucks could have gotten into those markets.
Well, as you said off the top, right, we're definitely in the stage of the season now where the appetite for activity is kind of overwhelming the appetite for it to be good activity. You know what I mean? Like, people want to see transactions and then we'll figure it out later, but at least they want something to be excited about right now. Probably you're going to get that at some point over the next 8 days, although we'll see how it eventually all plays out. Now, Donnie and Dolly, Rick Dollywall connected the Canucks with a handful of other names as well. And in addition to very familiar names like Marco Rossi and J.J. Paterka that we've heard they've been involved in, they've been talking to Minnesota and Buffalo respectively about trying to acquire those players. Dollywall also suggests that Charlie Coyle in Colorado and Jared McCann in Seattle could be on Vancouver's radar. And I get this idea of you got to do your due diligence. Any center that you think could be available, like any plausible top six center that you think could be available across the league, you got to call and you got to check in. This is another situation, though, with both of these players where it's hard for me to see the desire. Like Colorado, maybe they want to do the remake the team thing again, right? And you know,
yeah, or they have guys another out. Opportunity.
Sure, right? So that could happen. But like Seattle, what is the burning desire for Seattle to ship out Jared McCann? And so it gets to the kind of thing where it's like maybe they'd consider it, but you're probably going to have to absolutely blow them away with an offer. And I don't know if the Canucks are in a position to do that. And so it's the kind of thing where we're waiting to hear more names beyond Rossi and Paterka that they're in connection with. But then I hear them and I'm kind of like, well, this is why Marco Rossi makes sense, because there's actual desire to move on from the player from Minnesota's perspective in a way that I don't think there would be with Jared McCann in Seattle.
Yeah, Jared McCann also is going to turn 30 by the time the conference finals turn around next year. He is a winger at this point in his career, I'm pretty sure. And, mm-hmm. and not because he can't play center, but because since he moved to the wing, he's been really, really good, right? Like a 70, like a 25 goal, 70 point guy pretty consistently for the Seattle Kraken, who have basically used him on the wing throughout his time there. I don't think you want to mess with that, right? Now, again, this is not, I think he's a winger because he can't play center. This is, I think he's a winger because he's a really good winger, right? And so, you know, he's fast. He thrives in chaos. Obviously, it didn't work out for him here when he was 18 or 19 or whatever. The club mangled that, completely bungled his development, I think, rushed him when he wasn't ready, didn't really have a plan for him. Remember, he was sitting out games regularly.
Yep.
He never understood why organization wasn't communicative enough with him. And then he was a confused 19-year-old who was like annoyed by insane usage. And I think vets on the team got on him for that. And look, I think he grew up too, right? I don't think he was at a point in his life necessarily where he had a full understanding of how to carry himself in the NHL yet. So look, I think Jared McCann's a really, really good player. We know that Jim Rutherford has traded it for him before, right? He acquired him from yep. Florida back when he was the general manager of the Pittsburgh Penguins. And notably, it was Ron Hextall that traded him to Toronto, not Jim Rutherford, right? So this is a player that the sort of current Canucks brass acquired when they were in charge of the Penguins organization, and he was a player that they never cut loose. He was a player that they clearly quite liked. So those are all things to keep in mind. This is a guy with some history with this front office, and yeah, a really interesting potential trade target if the Canucks were, you know, able to find a fit there. 2 years left at $5 million. That's going to be a steal.
Yep.
I'm pretty confident about that. I think the price here would be huge. Like, I think you're looking at something like a Zacha thing, where in order to consider this, the Kraken would have to be either like closing in on a Nikolaj Ehlers quality guy,
right,
and making plans to create space to do that. Although they have space to do that, like they have space to add a Nikolaj Ehlers type guy and keep McCann, or considering really like, or there's someone they really love in the draft. Right,
like right, or there's like someone at 15 that they are desperate right. to take for some reason. Yeah,
yes, or they want the draft capital to move up the board, or something like that. Like it would have to be something, you know, somewhat tectonic in terms of a shift in their priorities and approach here. And so yeah, I mean, it's an interesting name, but it's hard to see why they'd be in a rush to trade McCann for futures or the sorts of assets that the Canucks would prefer to part with at this juncture.
No, and especially when, I mean, that, like, we've talked so much about just the sheer number of teams, not just who want to get better, but have a level of desperation to get better and really take a meaningful step forward next year. And I mean, Seattle's got to be near the top of that list. With they've generated so little traction and consistent success on the ice since they've come into the league. There has to be a tremendous sense of urgency from Ron Francis in the front office there to get better. And so if you're trading one of your best forwards, like, yeah, I know you've got some interesting young players down the middle and all that, but he's playing on the wing already for you. If you're trading one of your best young forwards, it's got to be for a very, very specific pressing reason. And look, you make a good point about, hey, if someone's falling down the draft board or they get wind that they think they're going to be able to do something in free agency, which makes a lot of sense. Those are the types of opportunities that can kind of unexpectedly pop up over the course of this week as teams get a better sense of what might be possible, who might be there in the draft, what they want to do with their own players, all of those things. So we shouldn't completely write it off, but it's just as we sit here right now with the facts we have available to us, it's difficult for me to see the logic from the Kraken side of things. But again, the Canucks have to be doing their due diligence and checking in on all of these types of players just in case something does materialize. Before we get out of this segment, I do, of course, want to mention also the Abbotsford Canucks, who will be playing Game 6 of the Calder Cup this afternoon at 4 in Charlotte. And this comes after they lose 4-3 in overtime on Saturday in Abbotsford, missing their chance to clinch the Calder Cup on home ice, which would have been just incredible if they had been able to do it. And we got confirmation, by the way, from Josh Elliott-Wolf that Connor Bedard and Kent Johnson were in attendance for that one. So two local products, young local products in the NHL showing up to support the Abbotsford Canucks in that one. And the moment, I know there was a bunch of chances for the Abbey Canucks in overtime of that game, but the Max Sasson ringing it off the post.
Yeah.
Woo, if, and look, there's two more chances to do it in Charlotte, so I don't want to bury anything one way or another here, but if it goes a certain way, that's the moment that's going to haunt them. Because that wasn't like, you know, sometimes it goes off the post and it's like, well, the goalie had the angle covered and it was off the outside of the post and it was close, but not that close. Like that was, he had him beat clean, no doubt about it, and it goes off the post and out. That's the potential to be a nightmare down the road for those players.
Yeah, I mean, that was the night that the Abbotsford American League team truly became the Canucks. No, I mean, they were pretty unlucky, I thought, in overtime. I thought they were
the better
team.
Well, I mean, then you look at how the goal goes in, right, for the Checkers.
That was a wildly unlucky sequence for a team that, you know, it was on the precipice, had it right in front of them, and it didn't get done for reasons that I don't think actually say anything about how they performed. That was a team that seized the opportunity, by and large, and the puck just didn't bounce their way.
Yeah.
And so that's always a tough way to, you know, lose a really high stakes, potential clinching game on home ice that would have absolutely brought the Valley, I think, to its knees in terms of the excitement level in that building. And then, you know, the truth is that the series has looked very different on Charlotte ice through five games, right? So they need to make sure that these next two aren't, you know, similar to that in terms of the territorial flow, in terms of the ability that the Checkers have to control play here. It's going to be critical that these games don't look that way, because games one and two certainly did, even if Abbotsford was able to pull out a result in a split in the first leg of this series.
Yeah. Still have a 3-2 series lead as it goes back to Charlotte for game 6 and 7. But as you said, you're hoping that they can build on the process that they did really well in Abbotsford and retain that as this goes back to the East Coast, and they'll have two chances to clinch the Calder Cup in Charlotte. Again, game 6 is this afternoon at 4. Dan and Sat will have pregame as part of Canucks Central starting at 3. You'll be able to hear Brandon Astle and Landon Ferraro on the call at 4. And then I believe Dan and Sat are doing an hour post-game coverage as well for this one, even for the road game. So lots of Abbey Canucks coverage coming up on the station later on today. Vancouver Giants, it's never too early to get your Vancouver Giants season tickets. Tickets start at under $19 at vancouvergiants.com/season tickets. I also, of course, want to remind everyone about the Sportsnet 650 Jays Care 50/50, which is now live. You can buy your tickets anytime between now and July 7th. Halford and Brough will do the draw on July 8th and announce the winner. But don't wait. Get your tickets now. You could win half the jackpot. The other half supports Challenger Baseball, a program that helps kids of all abilities across BC thrive through sport. Tickets start at just $10 with bundles for even more chances to win. Get your tickets now at jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com, or you can text money to 650-650 now to get the link sent directly to you. Must be 19 or older and live in BC to play. Let's make a big impact together. Send those texts in. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We got an open segment up next. We can continue to look ahead to the offseason and what the Canucks might do over the next week or 8 days here. It is Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. JanPro, from showrooms to stockrooms and everything in between, JanPro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit JanPro.ca. As mentioned, Scott Wheeler coming up later. From the show from The Athletic, covering the NHL draft, which is Friday and Saturday this week. And then we'll chat with Kevin Woodley at 1:30 as well. But in the meantime, we can dive in to the inbox. And this one comes in from Saskatchewan Joe, who says, with the lack of moves and seeing Zegras and Duchesne move, what is management's plan here? Are they trying for these assets or are they waiting for something specific? And then he follows up with, for the love of God, give us impatient, knee-jerk people something to chew on. And that really is like the two sides of the coin of this moment that we're in, right? Like, there's just such an overwhelming appetite to see the moves happen, to see everything come to fruition. And to Saskatchewan Joe's original question, like, are they trying for these assets or waiting for something specific? I mean, we've heard Duchesne didn't get a chance to bid on, right? Because he was a pending unrestricted free agent who didn't make it to market. But everything we've heard is that they would have been very, very interested in signing Matt Duchesne should he have made it to July 1st. I'm sure they at least had conversations about Mason Marchman. I'm sure they had conversations about Trevor Zegras. I think there's a mix of they're involved in all of these, but they're also trying to strike that balance of, okay, we want to be aggressive, we want to be active, we want to do whatever we can to improve our team, but you don't want to jump the gun and spend assets on, for example, a Trevor Zegras. Like, okay, hey, we got to put all of our assets into Trevor Zegras, and then 2 days from now, the landscape could change significantly and something could come available that you weren't expecting, and all of a sudden you're out of the running for that. So it, as much as I understand why everyone is maybe getting a little nervous, right, desperately wants to see the moves that are going to happen, this is why NHL GMs and NHL presidents of hockey operations make the salaries they do, right? Like, it's this time of year where you have to so carefully and so delicately weigh, do we go right now and, you know, increase our offer for this player, or do we wait 24, 48, 72 hours to see what develops before the draft? I can't sit here and tell you if they've got that balance right or not, but that's the process they're trying to go through right now.
Yeah, I also think, I mean, I think the Zegras thing, there's a lot of different elements you have to unpack with it, right? I don't know exactly whether or not the Canucks were in on this one, but I can tell you that Philadelphia was really excited to be able to roll the dice on this sort of risk or reward proposition. I can also tell you that they plan to start and try to see if it'll work for him at center. Now, we know that the Canucks needed a center above all else, but Zegras is like a 40% faceoff guy. There are real concerns about whether or not he'll be able to stick there. Mm-hmm. And for the Philadelphia Flyers, you know, that they take this gamble effectively, right? And they still have 6 picks.
Yep.
In the first 2 rounds. Right? Like, this was one of 4 second rounders that they had. They take on Zegras' $5.75 million cap hit, and they still have 22-ish million in cap space, with like Cam York and Jacob Pelletier being their only key RFAs, right? And they don't have key UFAs, right? So for Philadelphia, they were positioned to take a swing, and it doesn't like close the door on them pitching whomever on July 1, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't meaningfully impact their draft capital. Losing Poehling, whatever, right? Not a huge deal. We'll replace him in free agency. And I think the equivalent package for the Canucks, you do that deal, and you know, even if you're sending out a Drew O'Connor or a Teddy Bluger type fourth liner in the trade, right? You're still talking about it taking up $3 million of cap space. So now you have $9 million, right? As opposed to the 12 that they currently have. You trade a second and a fourth. Now you have 5 picks in this draft class, much less 6 picks in the first 2 rounds, right? It's a totally different world in terms of positional, like relative buying power, right? So it's easy to look at the overall price and be like, well, the Canucks should have been in on this. And I agree, by the way. I think they should have been in on this. And I don't know whether or not they were yet. I'll try and figure that out before we do the show tomorrow. But from a relative purchasing power perspective, you can see why for Philadelphia, this is a lower cost relative to their asset holdings, relative to their available cap space. Whereas for the Canucks, it would have actually been like probably their most significant swing of the summer, right? In a different type of way. And for a player who, you know, he's played center, right?
Yep.
But isn't a center. Is that something you're comfortable with? Or frankly, would you rather circle back on Pugh Suter, right? And I can see the argument for both. But I think this team needs to be chasing upside above all else. And Zegras has real, like, top of the lineup upside, especially if he can iron out some of his work away from the puck and just sort of mature as a player and a person off the ice.
Yeah, and it's the relative purchasing power, of course, plays a role here. But I think more than that, it's like because of the Canucks having relatively less purchasing power and less ability to do multiple things, the stakes of getting whatever move you do make right are way higher for them than Philly. Right.
Yes.
Like this can be one of three or four gambles that Philly takes, all like roughly costing this much this summer. And, you know, nobody would really blink an eye. Right. Like they could easily do that. They're also at a different stage of their team building process. Right. So they have a little bit more flexibility to say, hey, we're going to get a bunch of, you know, high pedigree guys who haven't turned out. And, you know, not all of them will turn out, but we'll see. And we'll try to keep the ones and help them develop and keep the ones that do flash for us or hit for us. I think it's harder just one because of the cap space and the assets to get guys like that for the Canucks, but also it's going to be really difficult if you only come away with question marks this summer. Like, I don't think that's where they want to be. And that might be where they have to be ultimately because there's not going to be anything but question marks really available to change hands here. But I think when you're in the position like the Canucks are, you have to have a much higher degree of certainty that this player is a fit. This player is going to work. Right? You're going to be less likely to take the big gambles. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the correct stance, but it's like if you only have a couple of swings at bat, you know what I mean, at the plate,
yeah.
You've got to make sure you're taking really, really good swings when you get up there. And I think that's part of what we're seeing from the Canucks as well.
Yeah, I think, and I think that's a decent formulation from the perspective of, you know, now we know the stakes of this offseason in terms of, you know, frankly, it being necessary that this team improve sufficiently to, like, even get another run with this core.
Yeah.
Like, let's be real, right? Like, that's, we're talking existential stakes for this era of Canucks hockey, flat out. And that's not dramatic. That's not media-created, anxiety-driven, clickbaity. That's just, like, that's the truth here, okay? That's what we're talking about when we're talking about the Canucks offseason here. And so I kind of like the idea that it's like they're out of outs.
Yeah.
You know, like on some level, advancing the runner, right? Because what you need is the one run to tie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like what you need is the two runs to tie. So it's like in some ways the leverage is a little bit different than it would be in a normal situation where you're just trying to score as many runs as you can before you get three outs. And I do think that that's sort of analogous to where we're at. Like it's midnight in terms of the Canucks, you know, always impatient, fitful build that's extended mostly unsuccessfully across the last decade. We're in the ninth inning here. And, you know, this is a moment where more than anything else, they need to get, you know, a run across the plate. Like,
mm-hmm.
and if that means bunting, if that means playing some smaller ball, so be it.
Yeah, I think it's a huge factor.
I can't believe I advocated for bunting on our program.
I know. I
genuinely apologize.
I had to fight back my disgust there a little bit because I absolutely.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah,
it's a decent analogy.
I do. But you have to just play it differently. You have to play it differently than if you've got a ton of runway in front of you. And I think just the mentality of, look, as I was saying, you got to try to strike that balance. And that you have to strike the balance between that aggression to get better and to be willing to bet on upside and take a little bit of a gamble at least, while also being wary that, you know, you don't have that many options. You're not going to be able to do it a bunch of times in a row. So if you're identifying this is the player we're putting a lot of our assets into acquiring, you better be really, really sure. You have to have a high degree of confidence that you're at least going to have a chance for that player to be successful once he joins the team. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And another text came in, Mike in East Vancouver, who says, I'm getting summer of Louis Erickson vibes, and I'm terrified. I will say,
was a uniquely bad summer.
Yes.
Because that was also the Olevi pick. I mean, that was
That's from a Canucks perspective, and then you look at league-wide at the UFA contracts that summer as well, right?
Yeah, you're right. In some ways, the Louis Erickson deal was like part of
a
particularly cursed group of UFA spending. I always said that when talking about like the Beagle-Roussel deals being worse, right, or the OEL trade being far worse among the many Benning-era sins, mm-hmm. was like at least the Louis Erickson deal fell within the normal scope of teams operating.
It was in step with what everyone else was doing.
Correct. It was in step with the market. You don't get points if you go off a cliff because your entire herd does necessarily, but at least they were within the herd.
Yeah.
At least they were.
Well, we get it.
I know the path. The path is trade all our expirings for OEL, right? And it's like, that's worse.
But and I will say, if you want to look at like a silver lining from a Canucks perspective and you're comparing it to the Louis Erickson summer, I mean, Louis Erickson, awful contract. He was coming off a 30-goal season, right? How many guys in free agency this year are coming off 30-goal seasons? It's like there's just such a thin market that there's going to be probably some sticker shock contracts handed out, but I don't see – like who's your bet to be like the worst UFA contract
signed? Do you actually
want to
know? Do you want to know how many 30-goal scorers there are in this free agent class? How many do you think?
Well, there's Tavares.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's just like there's not a lot of like I'm trying to even think because that year it was like Lucic, Okposo, was it Andrew Ladd that year as well? Yep. I think Louis Erickson, and they were just like there just happened to coincidentally be a lot of guys who it was like were very recently very productive, but you could also like see the cliff coming for all of them. You know what I mean? And they all got paid. And I don't know if there's that many analogous players in this offseason. Like who's your bet to be the contract that ages worse from this UFA class?
Oh, man. There's so many.
Trent Frederick?
There's so many options. Trent Frederick honestly has a shot, but I think $4 million is like going to be pretty manageable in a $115 million cap environment. You know, I mean, the truth is where we're headed, I don't think it's even that bad. Like, all told, like, what we're talking about, 3.85, right? As part of a $115 million cap environment, right? It's the equivalent of 2.5, 2.7 million in the flat cap era, right? It's like, okay, that sucks, but it's not completely
devastating. You're not screwed for the rest of the contract because of it.
How about this is an unfortunate stat, by the way. There are 5 25 goal scorers among this unrestricted free agent class, and 2 of them are expiring from the Vancouver Canucks.
Incredible stuff.
Who, should these players walk, which, you know, sounds like Besser is going to test the market.
Yep.
The club expects Pew suitors to still test the market, although they always felt like they had a good shot to re-sign him and obviously have resumed conversations. So I guess we'll see. But it's like, man, I mean, the Leafs have 2 of those 5, and I think they deserve to be blasted for the way they've managed like the Mitch Marner situation. The fact that they're in a position for Mitch Marner to walk with no return and his era of Leafs hockey didn't result in them making the conference final once, like that should be devastating. That's devastating. And I mean, to a lesser extent, but losing Brock Besser and Pugh Suter for no return, man, that's
tough
is
stuff.
Tough. I think Jack Roslovic's an interesting contender.
Okay.
I think Mikael Granlund's interesting contender.
I think if you're looking for the Louis Erickson, Okposo, if the analogy to that summer, I think Granlund's the closest you're coming. To me, that's the guy who fits that mold the best. And if you know, desperate team X, that's like, man, we gotta pay the bad team tax to convince talent to come here. And our GM is desperate not to get fired, so we just need to do whatever we can. And all right, hey, how long do we have to go for Mikael Granlund? All right, I guess we'll do it. That one is a very intriguing one to me.
Yeah, I think Justin Brazeau is a good dark horse contender,
But Louis Erickson got 6x6. Like, what? Justin Brazeau's not going to get that, especially not adjusted for the cap, for this cap era, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like, it's not going to be nearly as damaging as what those guys got.
But he's like pretty young, and he's been decently productive. I mean, could he beat the $4 million? Like, if he gets five times five or something, I think that's a pretty scary proposition given how odd his profile is overall.
Sure.
You know, so there's a lot of ways that this can go wrong for a lot of teams with a lot of these players.
Yes, that's true. I just think, like, I even don't see the, like the Chandler Stephenson landmine from last summer. You know what I mean? Where I was like, oh, that one I can see a mile away is going to be a nightmare.
Look, Pew Suter's such a good defensive player that it kind of limits the downside to a fairly significant extent. But, you know, this is still a scary spot to be in where a guy's coming off of the ka-ching scoring run that he had late in the year.
In a massively elevated role that he's not going to duplicate, that you don't want him to duplicate.
No.
Yeah.
Where he's like largely inefficient if he continues to play that role for this team. So, you know, I think it's pretty dicey. I think there's a lot of different dicey options here. From a Canucks perspective, and from everybody, for every single team in the league here, and yeah, I mean Sam Bennett, if Sam Bennett tests the market, like if Sam Bennett really wanted to push his leverage to the max, you know, I think that would be a very frightening deal. If you were talking 7 times $11 million for Sam Bennett, you know, that would be scary, right? Matt Duchene probably had an opportunity to do it if he'd wanted to. Right. If he wanted to play anywhere, he probably could have gotten. And so this is the other thing that we're bumping into here, where you've got this like small assortment of Imperial era teams that seem to be able to attract and retain top talent at well below market rates. And we'll see how deep this goes with Marchand, with Aaron Ekblad, and with Sam Bennett. But I think the Duchene example is a really strong indicator of sort of exactly where this is going, right? In this league, we talk a lot, or I talk a lot, and you indulge me on this program, Jamie, about sort of the changes that have been wrought in hockey, where you've got, you know, save percentage declining, shooting percentage going up, less random goal scoring events result in true talent having a greater impact on the outcome of games. And what's the natural outgrowth of that? Well, it's player empowerment. It's that players have a larger say in outcomes overall. And if players are going to be laser set on picking spots as opposed to absolutely maxing out their market value, right? And this, you know, that becomes a really fascinating spot to be in where getting back to the top sort of requires some level of momentum.
Yes.
Right? Where having the sort of cataclysmic season that the Canucks did, where, you know, players are unhappy and asking for trades and the coach is departing after the season, and there's just like a feeling within the industry of like, well, the Canucks are on everyone's no trade clause, right? Where that becomes like the disadvantage you have to account for or deal with, right? Becomes almost more decisive than the amount of cap space you have or the amount of resources you have, or frankly, how you're positioned from a true talent perspective, where, you know, the Canucks are probably a wild card caliber team on true talent as it stands today, right? They're in that mix with Minnesota and Utah and St. Louis going into this season. You know, maybe that changes. Teams like Anaheim and Utah certainly have the potential to put more space between themselves and the Canucks between now and September 1st or what have you. But, you know, that, like, this isn't a bad team. This is a team with one of the five most impactful two-way skaters in the game.
Yeah.
Right? There should be a path for this Canucks team to have a good year and a fun year and bounce back. They were the seventh most injured team on a like relative to the cap space of their man games lost. There's a lot of they were 26th in save percentage, right? And that was mostly the performance of their backups of their non, like, outside of Kevin Lankinen, right? So like there's a lot of the things that we usually look for in talking about what a bounce back team looks like, right? And So, you know, this it's not as grim as it feels, but if it feels as grim as it seems in the lead up to July 1, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, given the way that we're seeing players make decisions and how teams are doing business at this juncture.
Well, and one of our other favorite talking points on this program is the like meeting in the middle of the NBA and the NHL. And of course, I mean, it's waned now and it is waning in the NBA, but there was a solid, 10-year stretch there where like the principal team building philosophy was get a star and then use that star to attract other stars, right? And then do, and then, and that star is probably going to tell you like, okay, hey, I want you to go out and get this guy, and you trade whatever you need to do to go out and get that guy. And of course, we saw the NBA champion crowned last night, who is from Oklahoma City, and they, you know, had stars on their team. They all got moved on from for a variety of reasons, and they had to figure out a different direction. And like the LA Clippers, who acquired Paul George from the Thunder, they were very much in that, well, we have Kawhi Leonard, we got to go get Paul George to play with him, we'll pay whatever price is necessary, we have to do that. And Oklahoma basically said that strategy is not going to work for us, so we got to go hard into the other direction and trade Paul George and get all of these, you know, get SGA, get the pick that becomes Jalen Williams, get all this other stuff and build like that. And somebody texted in, I think it was Sepp in Vancouver, is any team going to pivot and lean into the seller's market where it's basically only Pittsburgh who's really looking to sell? And even, you know, I was reading, I think it was Josh Yoey at The Athletic, and it's like, well, they'd consider trading Rickard Rakell if the price was right. So it's not like it's a fire sale in Pittsburgh even. And I do think that if you are a team that doesn't, if you're not a premier destination team, right, trying to beat them at that game where it's like, we're going to become even more desirable for top UFAs than Florida is or Dallas is or Nashville or whatever, like you're probably not. So you're going to have to try to pick another strategy. And that might mean amassing that kind of embarrassment of young riches that then makes you desirable for kind of the finishing pieces to come.
Well, I mean, we're probably a year ahead of schedule in terms of having this conversation, but there's like a pretty clear timeline in terms of when you'd want to accomplish that. And evidence of it over the weekend where you have two homegrown NHL stars attending the AHL game.
Yep.
Because there's a chance the Canucks AHL team wins a championship, and those guys grew up in this city. They're just huge hockey nerds.
Yep.
Right, which is why they were there. They're not there because they grew up Canucks fans.
No, they were scouting their future teammates on the Canucks.
Sure. look, that's probably not the case.
No.
But it doesn't matter. There's still something instructive about their level of interest, right? And the fact that they're at home and training already. You know what I mean? That this is home base. Like, there's no reason for the Canucks and for Vancouver to be an undesirable location for free agents.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
even the taxes thing, which is real to some extent, like, it hasn't stopped them from being able to sign American-born players in the past, right? I mean, it didn't stop them from getting JT Miller under contract. It didn't stop them from XYZ guy who, you know, the market said would be hard to sign, and then it turned out wasn't nearly as difficult as everyone as everyone sort of painted it to be in the lead up to that spot. So, yeah, I mean, look, there is sort of a timeline here where you're going to have this golden era of BC born and bred hockey players coming up and having their own opportunity to have leverage and have say over where they go, and making sure that this organization is in a different world in terms of public perception and in terms of perception within the league, right? Whether it's the practice facility, whether it's how this team does business, whether it's your assets to make those sorts of trades and jockey and put yourself in position, like, that has to be top priority for this organization going forward here.
Yeah, it's an important way to look at it, I think, especially, as you said, going forward, considering the talent from this area. We'll take a break. You can keep sending your texts in, 650-650. Scott Wheeler from The Athletic covering the NHL draft, which starts on Friday. Will the Canucks pick 15th overall, or will they trade that pick before the draft? We can ask Scott about that, but also who they might be targeting if they do stay at 15. That's next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by your Lower Mainland Boston Pizza. Fast lunch doesn't have to mean fast food. Satisfy your midday cravings by choosing a main, side, and drink for only $15 served in 20 minutes or less. Guests on Sportsnet 650 call in on the hotline. Powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. And now joining us to chat about the NHL draft, round one's on Friday. The rest of the rounds on Saturday. From The Athletic, covering the draft, he is Scott Wheeler. Scott, thanks for doing this today. How are you?
I am in the thick of it.
Yeah.
This is it. It's the home stretch, the crunch time, whatever cliche a hockey player would use for where I'm at right now. That's about where I'm at. We're grinding through the final few days. And then once I'm in LA, oddly enough, once I actually get to the draft, it's a bit of a breather because all of the work is done until the picks start getting made and then you've got to review them. But the actual day or two before the draft is mostly shaking hands and saying hello to people and less sort of sitting in front of a laptop. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, we were saying off the top of the show, we're really in the sweet spot of the kind of transaction frenzy portion of the NHL calendar now. And I mean, obviously for you as someone who covers the draft, it's even more pronounced this week specifically. How would you say, just kind of overall, like, how certain are you? How much of a handle do you have on this draft and how it might play out relative to some recent drafts?
Honestly, I feel really good about the handle that I have on this draft. There have been a couple of tricky drafts in recent memory. The big one, obviously, being the Slafkovský, Shane Wright, Logan Cooley, Simon Nemec, that sort of foursome at the top of the draft coming out of the pandemic. And that draft in and of itself, because of the pandemic and how many kids were playing over in, frankly, some pretty unconventional leagues over in Slovakia and many kids in the third tier of Swedish hockey and the Hockey Ettan over in Sweden. That draft was just complicated in a lot of ways. Since then, we've gotten back to a bit of normalcy, and this draft has really crystallized for me over the second half of this season. I think we saw in October, November that clearly the sort of clear-cut best player, most talented player in this draft class was Matthew Schaefer. And then despite the injury, I don't think anyone has sort of wavered really from what they saw in November, December of Matthew Schaefer and just how much better he looked than most of the other players in this draft. And then beyond that, it sort of really crystallized in a couple of ways. A, there's this group of centers, and that's pretty rare at the draft, a group of natural centers that have sort of fallen in line in that second tier in this age group. And then you get into sort of the third tier, which is a cluster of a combination of the top wingers and the top defensemen after Matthew Schaefer. So it has sort of been a little formulaic in some ways, if you will. You talk to NHL scouts and everybody feels about the same way about their lists as they do my list. And that's a pretty rare thing this time of the year. Typically, my list diverges from whether it's my colleague Corey Pronman at The Athletic or NHL scouts, it can diverge in some pretty stark and contrasting ways. In this year's age group, because it's not the sexy group that it was in 2023, and because there aren't all of those defensemen that were at the top of the draft like there were a year ago in 2024, it just hasn't sort of been a source of debate or uncertainty for a lot of folks, frankly. My colleague Corey and I, we do these debate pieces at The Athletic every year, and there's been some very, very contentious debates and players really right at the top of the draft even that we've disagreed on, I should say, over the years, including last year with Carter Yakimchuk and a couple of years prior with players like Zach Benson. This year, there just wasn't that. We were struggling to sort of find players that we were all that far apart on. I think that speaks to this draft maybe being a little bland and also just some really concrete kind of tiers and fall offs in this age group.
Yeah, and so as you said, you Schaefer at the top, and I mean everyone, that seems to be consensus. No surprises expected there, and then that next group of, you know, Misa, Desnoyers, Frandell, etc. And it feels like maybe after that is when some surprises could start to happen. So kind of in that seven and beyond range, do you think that's where kind of things could get maybe a little bit more unpredictable, or even after that, does it stay pretty chalky from your perspective?
I think it will be pretty chalky through the first, I don't know, 16, 17 picks. I think I could probably give you 18 names and they're all going to be within those 16, 17 picks on draft day. I don't think we're going to see a major faller from that group. I don't think we're likely to see a major riser. The one wild card in that group is Brandon Wheat, King Center, Roger McQueen. Roger has obviously dealt with some pretty serious back issues over the last year and a half, missed three major chunks of two different seasons, something that he's really been dealing with since not just last winter, but an entire winter prior. Not viewed by NHL scouts to be as serious as the back injuries that Caden Lindstrom dealt with. Caden Lindstrom still went fourth overall to the Columbus Blue Jackets, though. And if you were to pull 10 NHL scouts today, I think they would argue that they view Roger McQueen as further along as a prospect and as a better overall prospect than Caden Lindstrom was a year ago. So really interested to see where McQueen goes. I would expect he goes in that 8 to 10 range. I wonder about the Sabres at 9. I certainly wonder about the Anaheim Ducks at 10. If he were to somehow get past the Ducks at 10, I don't think the Pittsburgh Penguins at 11 would let him slip past them. So still going to go high, but the question with McQueen is, can he kind of break into that top 6-7 group that has really formed? And one player who's been added to that group in the second half is Brady Martin of the Sioux Greyhounds. And I think because Brady Martin is now in that mix, because Jake O'Brien of the Brantford Bulldogs is now in that mix, and people are very excited about both of those two players, that it makes it less likely that we're going to see a surprise jump from McQueen and a team that really takes a swing on McQueen and the talent of a 6'5", highly gifted, highly intelligent, skilled center. There's still a lot of appeal in that player type, as we all know. Everybody wants the Blake Wheeler or the Eric Staal or the Ryan Getzlaf. But do you take that player if there are other players at that position, at the center ice position, who are also high-end prospects in this draft class, just given the injury history? So he's kind of the wild card for me.
Scott, Intel dump time. What are you hearing about Vancouver at 15th overall?
The sense on Vancouver is twofold. First of all, there are two players that I believe, well, really three players that I've heard linked to them over the last couple of weeks. And I'll have this all reported and fleshed out in my mock draft at The Athletic, my final one at The Athletic tomorrow. But the one is Braden Coutts, who wouldn't have played far away, sort of projectable middle six center, captain with the Seattle Thunderbirds. They would have had eyes on him a lot. I believe they like him. They took him to dinner at the combine. And if you look at their pool and their current top prospects, say what you will about Jonathan Lekkerimäki and the playoffs that he's had in the AHL, which have been a major, major mixed bag. And have even sort of struggled to make much of an impact there with that group. He's their top forward prospect by and large. Willander, we know what Tom is and what he represents as a defenseman. They really don't have a solid, even like B-plus center prospect. So I wonder about Cole Reschne. I wonder about Braden Coutts. But they need to prioritize skill. And the one name who I've heard who may fall on draft day from that sort of consensus top 11, top 12 group, I think there's one player who could linger towards 15 or 16, and that's Victor Eklund of Djurgården, which is obviously the same club that Jonathan Lekkerimäki grew up with and developed with. Eklund is a fascinating player, excellent hockey player, one of the highest motors in the draft. I believe if he gets there at 15 to Vancouver, that they would strongly consider him. And then there's Cam Reid. Cam Reid's the defenseman in the group that I think could be really compelling, and I've heard connected a little bit to Vancouver. Cam's going to go in the 15 to 19 range. I truly believe if he gets to 16, 17 with the back-to-back Montreal Canadiens picks, I know that Montreal's high on Cam Reid and that he'll be in the mix for them. But 15 is kind of the start of the draft range for Cam Reed, a player who has been compared at the high end to that sort of Devin Taves, Josh Morrissey ceiling, the sort of 6-foot defenseman who maybe doesn't have ideal size, but can defend and use his mobility. And on top of having the offensive package, is a legit defender as a 6-foot defender. So Reed's another one that I would keep an eye on there, but Reed, Kootz, Reshny, Eklund, if he's there, those are kind of the 3-4 names that I've had tied to them.
Do you expect the Canucks to actually make a pick in the first round?
I think in a best-case scenario, they'd prefer not to, but there are a lot of teams that are trying to move their picks in this draft class. I often think you can actually win at the margins by targeting draft picks in sort of quote-unquote underrated or poor draft classes, if you will. Every draft class produces talent, even weak ones, which this one is perceived to be. I think teams should actually go the other direction instead of selling in sort of poor draft classes, if you will. I've always been a huge advocate for adding picks in those draft classes if you can get them at lower value. I think you're selling low on the market because everybody knows that this draft class in that 15 range where they're picking, that this draft class isn't as strong as everybody would like it to be. And on top of that, there is a very high concentration of picks in the first round this year. There are 7 different teams in the first round of this year's draft with multiple picks. There are 2 different teams in the first round of this year's draft with 3 picks. All of those teams, I keep hearing, are trying to be aggressive to move up. There are also teams from sort of within the first round that aren't married to their picks, whether that's the New York Rangers at 12, and I believe the New York Rangers will keep that pick and punt on next year's pick, which will make it unprotected for the Pittsburgh Penguins. But I believe they'll keep that pick, and if they don't make it, they will try to move it. I think the Buffalo Sabres at 9 would be interested in moving their pick. I have heard that the Chicago Blackhawks at 3 and the Utah Mammoth at 4 have talked with multiple teams each about moving their pick. So I just think there are too many cooks in the kitchen, if you will, this year, too many teams that are trying to move their picks and not enough teams that are interested in getting into those ranges or interested in paying the prices that are out there. And as a result, I do wonder if it's actually a harder year than normal, even with a lot of quote unquote activity and talk. I actually do wonder if it's a harder year than normal to be the team that pulls off a move. So I think I would expect that the Canucks would be interested in moving that pick if they could. I'm not sure how practical that is.
Well, and one of the other interesting dynamics, I think, is, as you mentioned, there's all these teams with multiple picks and, you know, even like Utah and Chicago near the top of the draft who are very aggressive. But the flip side of it is we keep hearing there's so few selling teams. Like, what are you putting on what are you getting back that makes it worth moving the 3rd or 4th overall pick for? And so I think it's great that all of these teams are aggressive and want to move their picks, but there's only so many players that are worth that much draft capital that are going to be available. And that number might be 0. So it does kind of feel like something's got to give here. Like, not everyone is going to be able to pull off all of these big swing home run deals, because there's just not that many current NHL players that would make sense to trade those types of picks for.
Yes. On the flip side, if there is a silver lining, I think the silver lining is that because the free agent class is atrocious, that teams recognize that they have to move other assets, that there are going to have to be some hockey trades because the cap's going up and because nobody has anybody that they want to spend their money on in free agency. And the players that they did want to spend their money on in free agency keep being snatched up by the teams that they were already playing on, whether it's Matt Duchene, soon to be Sam Bennett, I would expect, you go down the list. Suddenly we've got a pretty dry crop. We've got a rising cap. And the only way to add salary and to fill out your roster and to fill the needs of your roster heading into an important summer for so many teams is to try to make a hockey deal. And one of the best places to make a hockey deal is the draft. And on top of that, teams have argued and argued and argued that if they go to a decentralized draft format and they can get off of the draft floor and away from prying eyes, that deals will be easier to make. I'm not sure whether I believe that at all. I think that's mostly just private NHL GMs who don't like having cameras in their face while they're making their moves and don't like having people listen over their shoulders while they're on their phone calls. But they will argue that if they're on the phone and they're in their draft war room, that it's easier to make things happen. So now it's up to them to, if that's the case, I want to see a show on Friday and Saturday in terms of transactions and movement. We did actually very rarely we get movement at the draft. There have been a few brutal years in recent years where no transactions have happened, but I will give them credit. Last year, there was Mikhail Sergachev. There were five or six actual hockey trades that happened during round one of the draft. So pressure's on for a repeat of that, even if I don't think it's even if I feel like everybody is trying to do the same thing.
They got to deliver now, right? Like they wanted the decentralized draft, and if they're telling me, I was skeptical about it, but if they're selling that it's going to lead to more transactions, look, I'll accept it. But they got to deliver. They got to step up and make good on that promise and give us some fireworks at this one. We've seen a couple of players really shoot up draft boards over the last couple of months, and this is something that tends to happen, right? I'm thinking of guys like Radim Mertka, the big right shot defenseman, Brady Martin. And, you know, the physical tools of these guys, the way they play the game,
yep.
As we get later and later in the process, they shoot up draft boards. Is there another player? I mean, we all expect those guys to be, you know, top 10 picks at this point. Is there another player kind of late riser that you think could kind of surprise people by going a lot higher than expected on draft day?
There are two Russians that I keep hearing, and that's been a theme over the last couple of years. Dan Milstein and Gold Star Hockey do their sort of Fort Lauderdale camp now every year that has been hotly attended by NHL scouts and general managers to sort of get eyes on the Russian players that they've struggled to watch in person since the outbreak of the invasion in Ukraine. And as a result, there always seems to be, or at least over the last two drafts, there has seemed to be a bit of a late push for some of those Russian kids who come over and maybe surprise teams by speaking better English than they thought, or by looking sort of thicker and stronger and more physically advanced than they thought. There was certainly that sort of sense coming out of the camp last year with Ivan Demidov and just how strong he looked. He went into the camp listed at 5'11 and came out of the camp being listed at 6'1. So that didn't hurt him either. But this year there are two kids that have really sort of popped, two Russian kids that a lot of NHL teams seem to be talking about and who I both think are likely to go, if not in the, one of them's going in the first round for sure. And the other one, if not late first, it will be one of the very first picks of day two. The first one is Danil Prokhorov, a 6'5" winger out of Russia, scored a lot of goals in the MHL this year, but struggled to produce elsewhere. Just plays a very honest, hard to play against, physical north-south game, good skater for 6'5", can rip the puck, intimidating physically, gets after it on the cycle, and teams just view him as sort of that Alexei Toropchenko mold that everybody loves these days, which sort of adds size to a top nine and can get up and down the sheet. Even if he only scores 20 goals and 40 points a season, I think teams will still be happy with him as a first round pick because of the size element and the way that the game is trending. And then the other one is a little bit at the opposite end of the spectrum. Alexander Zhirovsky, who is another winger out of Russia, but one of the most purely skilled players in this draft class, about 6 foot, 6 foot and a half, not a super big kid, lean and wiry, still needs to get some sort of muscle on him and get into the gym. But Zhirovsky, in terms of pure puck skill, there are kind of two players in this draft class that really popped as second round picks with high end puck skill. And Zhirovsky's one of them, and Riker Lee out of the USHL is another one. Just sort of puck on a string, magic to watch inside the offensive zone, dance some guys this year, sort of highlight real quality, maybe aren't the most physically advanced or the fastest players on the sheet, but because of the talent level are viewed as potential power play guys, and there just aren't very many power play guys that are available on day two or into round two. So those are two players to sort of keep an eye on here, because I think once the premium guys go, the really projectable guys go, and everybody's got a question mark or two, I always wonder about the high-end skill types that linger. And I think Zhirovsky and Riker Lee fit that profile. And then Prokhorov, I think, could maybe even go in the teens and will certainly go in the 20s if he doesn't. So I would qualify him as a riser as well.
Scott, great stuff. Really appreciate the time. Enjoy draft week in LA, and hopefully we get those fireworks this year.
Cheers, fellas. Won't be the same without everybody in the hockey world there, but I am not just hopeful, I am sure of it. Lock in a centralized draft for 2026.
Yeah,
I think we're going back there.
I think it certainly sounds like that. Thank you, Scott.
Cheers. Cheers, guys.
That is Scott Wheeler from The Athletic covering the NHL draft, and you can go and check out his final rankings at The Athletic right now. And as he said, expect to see a final mock draft from him sooner rather than later this week as well. And just to recap, the names...
He dropped so much good intel, so that means, as you know, listeners, our dear listeners, you are now obligated to go read that at theathletic.com.
That's correct. The sacred covenant of Canucks talk. When you get the Athletic preview, you got to go and check it out at The Athletic as well. And just to recap, names that he specifically connected to the Canucks, that he's heard in connection with the Canucks: Victor Ekelund, winger out of Sweden; Braden Coutts, center in the WHL; Cole Reschny, another center from the WHL; and Cameron Reed, which I don't think I had heard connected to the Canucks, a left shot defenseman out of Kitchener, who has a bit of an interesting profile. So we'll see. I mean, as he said, look, they definitely would like to trade the pick, but there's a lot of teams that would love to trade their first round pick, and not all of them are going to be able to do it. That's just not how it works. That's not how the market is setting up. So we should still at least leave the door open for the Canucks to make a pick. And there's some names that Scott has heard in connection with the team.
Jamie, I'm not leaving the door open.
No, it's still closed for you.
Yes.
So when does the door creak open for you? Like, as
when they make
when they walk
the
up to the podium?
Yeah,
or when Gary Bettman does, I guess.
Even then, I mean, I don't think I will be stunned if the Canucks ever end up on the clock on day one of the NHL draft this year. I will be stunned.
It is going to be hilarious if they do make the pick, because then, you know,
it could happen.
But what's going to happen, though, is because they'll do, even the way Scott answered there, he's like, well, they'd love to. They'll be disappointed if they don't trade the pick. It's going to be like an accountability press conference, you know what I mean? Rather than like, wow, you guys must be so excited you got this player. The tone of it is going to be implicitly like, what happened? Well, how did you guys end up making this pick? Which is just a hilarious situation for a team to be in.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, you know, the draft's in LA, right?
Yeah.
And so I would imagine that teams are lining up their, like, celebrity picker. You know?
Really, though? Are they get, like, does that make sense if the whole operation isn't there? I feel like
I
it's
would
just.
I assume so. I mean, it makes more sense because you don't have your GM there.
Yeah, but the commissioner is just going to do it, no? Like, that, I don't know.
I would assume at a decentralized draft in Los Angeles that you're going to have, like, a lot of celebs booked to be, like, guest pickers, much like the NFL draft does when it goes decentralized. You know, like at the NFL draft, you have all these guest people making, and I just wonder, like, do you like cheap out on the person you're sending if you're the Canucks? Like, are you like, not because they would, but because just like the practicalities of scheduling it? You know what I mean? It's like, it might not be worth your time.
Who's like the 10th most famous Canucks fan? Like,
oh man.
Will they have anyone? I mean, they'll just be like, hey, Gary, you do this one for us, all right? We didn't think we were going to be making the pick.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, that's Gary, you got this.
Yeah, we'll let you handle it, buddy, all right? Don't worry. I guess Cole Reschny, I guess. Gary, cool. Go. Okay, go.
Yeah.
That's basically what we're talking about here. All right, we will take a quick break here in a second. Kevin Woodley is going to join us on the other side. By the way, coverage of NHL Free Agency 2025 is brought to you by Homes by David L. Young of Dexter Realty. Here, there, everywhere, visit Homes by DavidLYoung.com. And just as a little preview, on July 1st, when free agency opens, we'll be on the air 9 to noon, so a little bit earlier, which is exciting because free agency opens officially at 9 a.m. Pacific time. So we'll be on right as the frenzy officially kicks off and the deals start to roll in. So watch for that on July 1st, Canucks Talk 9 to noon for free agent frenzy. Kevin Woodley joins the show next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We're broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors. for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at Dunbar.
Let's see how they get. They can't get away with this again, can they? Let's see.
Yeah, I mean, it's never been wise to bet against Jim Rutherford pulling off a big transaction. So I think that's important to keep in mind. I do find the question of, you know, what does plan B look like to be really fascinating. And this is something Drance and I were debating last week on the show. Like, what signal does that send if they end up circling back on Pugh Suter at this point? And, you know, you're going into next season with Elias Pettersson and Pugh Suter and Filip Hedl down the middle. And, you know, one of our listeners, I thought, made a really good point. It was Jim Rutherford himself at the end of the season who said, yeah, the acquisition cost for a top six center upgrade might be painful, but it might be even more painful not to go out and do it. And so I think, you know, it's not just that us and the fans have kind of invented this sense of urgency to really go out and improve at the top of your forward group. That's directly from management. And so I think it's fair for everyone who follows this team to really be looking at the stakes as being pretty high, considering that's what Jim Rutherford himself had to say at the end of the season. We dropped Woodley there. Missed my incredible question there. So we'll try to
get...
I
thought that was a really good question, Jamie.
Thank you. I
was on the
that.
Edge of my seat waiting to hear the answer.
I know. I was excited. I value Woodley's opinion so much, and
Bring
I respect his opinion
fire.
So much. I was like, I wonder what he's going to say about this. And then I got a resounding silence on the other. Woodley, we have you back.
Yeah, you know what? I think the truth serum, they missed the needle and went right into the phone and hit the hang-up okay. button.
I don't know where we lost you, but I was laying out as basically Jim Rutherford himself said, painful to get the top six center potentially in terms of acquisition cost, but maybe even more painful if we don't do it. So my point was there, they have already set the stakes very high, and I think us in the media and fans are in many ways just reacting to how they've kind of set what we should view the stakes as here.
And that's fair, right? But we still, like, until you see what that looks like, and in both in terms of what that upgrade is, how big that upgrade is, and what the cost is, it's kind of really hard to judge it, right? And again, I think you can make an argument based on what we expect it to maybe look like, that is it the wisest decision? We'll see. Right? We'll see. At the end of the day, this is the, as much as we like to prognosticate and look forward and all those things, like, I don't think many of us saw the year 2 years ago coming. And I'm not saying they're going to bounce back to that level, but everything kind of has to play out before you can really judge how it plays out.
Kevin,